You know, we've just gone through a very tumultuous period in the Jewish calendar, beginning with Chodesh Elul, and all of the Chodesh Elul, and then Rosh Hashanah, that's how it's made Shuva, Yom Kippur, and we had to see the Sukkot. My father used to tell a story about a Hasidic Rebbe, I don't remember who it was, who on Friday night of this coming Shabbat, of Shabbat Bereshis, stood up to make a kiddush, and he took the cup of wine, and the Hasidim were sitting around. And he stood there with a cup of wine on his hand and closed his eyes in meditation. And he stood there, and he stood there, and he stood there, and time went on. Eventually, the cup of wine fell off, and he still stood there with his hand outstretched for an unspecified period of time. Finally, he opened his eyes and came to. And he explained to his Hasidim what had happened. He says, you know, when a merchant goes to the marketplace and he spends whatever time there is in making transactions, buying merchandise, selling merchandise, disposing of some things, whatever, he's too busy to make a calculation of what did I accomplish? How much profit did I make? What kind of losses did I sustain? The first station, the first oasis, which is free of all of these activities, is Shabbat Bereshit. We're through with all of the Chodesh Elul and Shemei Tshuva and Sukkot. He says, so this is the first opportunity that I have, just like the person, the merchant who leaves the market, the first hotel that he stays at, he takes out all of his papers, takes out all of the records, reviews the transactions, and he comes to some conclusion of, what did I achieve during my period in the market? So the Rebbe said, this is what happened with me for the past 6 weeks. He says, I was trying to do tshuva, trying to dispose of my avedas, I was trying to do mitzvahs. And so I had a lot of transactions between me and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But I didn't have time to see, to make a summation of it. What did I accomplish? Tonight was the first opportunity I had, after all of the transactions, to see what did I accomplish. So it took me a while to think over what I have accomplished during the last month and a half. I'm impressed by that story because sometimes we don't take that kind of stock. Right? You know, there is a tradition that it is best on the day after Yom Kippur to daven in the morning wherever you daven on Yom Kippur. Why? Because the Satan is always out to condemn us. Right? And so after Yom Kippur, he says to Hashem, yeah, you're so happy with your children, you're so proud of your Jewish children. Right? Yes, yesterday they spent the whole 24 hours on Yom Kippur, but where are they this morning at the Minyan? Right? He says, in order to silence the criticism of the Satan, we should daven the morning after Yom Kippur at the same shul that we daven. And I think it's important to take a look after all that we've gone through in the past month. What have we come up with? Because what the Satan is telling Hashem is, yeah, for that whole month they were fine, but now on, the day after Yom Kippur, it's business as usual. Whatever they were before, that's what they are now, and they have not achieved anything. That would be a terrible shame. When we say in Sukkot and Kohelet, Hakol Havel, that everything is nothingness, it does not refer to this part of our behavior. We have to come away with something. Come away with what? The Rambam says in Teshuvah, and incidentally, I think we fail to grasp the greatness of the phenomenon of Teshuvah. The Talmud says that Hashem created Teshuvah before creation of the world. The world could not begin to exist without Teshuvah. And it's a tremendous gift from Hashem to us. But if you think about it, what is so special about it? Suppose that a person offends someone else, and he realizes it was a mistake. So he goes over to him and he says, I'm sorry about what I said, I'm sorry about what I did, it was foolish of me. And so the other person forgives him. So what's so big about that? Why did Hashem have to make a special creation of Teshuvah? It's a perfectly logical thing. So a person realizes that one made mistakes and is sorry about it and apologizes, so he should be forgiven. If that's our understanding of Teshuvah, then we fall short of the mark. Because you see, the things that Hashem tells us not to do are not in order to benefit Hashem. Eel states this very clearly. If you've done good, what do you think you've contributed to Hashem? And if you've done wrong, what do you think you've done to hurt Him? Hashem is beyond being affected by us. The Torah and mitzvahs, and particularly the midot, our character traits, our personality traits, those are the basis of what we were intended to be by Hashem as a human being. And I think we fail to realize that, and it may seem like a chutzpah to say this, that the overwhelming majority of the world, of the population, have no idea why they're existing. Now, surely our Musa teachers teach us that pleasure should not be the goal of life. And I came across a quote, not by a Musa, but by Albert Einstein. And Albert Einstein said, he said, to my way of thinking, a goal in life of contentment and pleasure and happiness is perfectly suitable for a herd of swine. That's not about Musa. That's one of the greatest physicists in the world. And it's unfortunate that if you read Einstein's philosophy, that he's just one tiny step short of having achieved the Torah philosophy because he wasn't exposed to it. But I have on my desk a sefer which never leaves my desk. Not that I learn it every day, I should, but at least it's there to remind me. It's to remind me that the first chapter begins in Mesilat Yesharim, Chovat Ha'adam Ba'olamoy. What is a person's obligation in the world? Unfortunately, too many people don't think about that. In the 1960s, there was a term was coined, if it feels good, do it. Right? And then if you take a look as to what kind of disaster that has wrought. And just in the past week, there was an announcement of a new drug that is now killing off young people by the dozens. A new drug that is 10 times as potent and 10 times as dangerous as heroin. And yet, young people go for it. Why? Because if the goal of life is seeking pleasure, right, then it makes perfectly good sense. You know, when Nancy Reagan, the first lady during Reagan's administration, when Nancy Reagan tried to curb the use of drugs by a program, just say no to drugs. And some people went around asking young people what they thought of this idea of just say no to drugs. And one 14-year-old young woman said, "Why? What else is there?" Now, our country has spent billions and billions, I'm sorry if I said that, I'm still going back to the days when I was an American dweller. It's no longer our country, this is my country. But the U.S. government has spent billions and billions of dollars trying to curb the use of drugs, and nothing is working. Nothing is working. And nothing can work as long as that 14-year-old young woman's question is unanswered. What else is there? It would seem that religion had the answer, and unfortunately there's been so much distortion of religion that even that is not the answer. But they're not even asking the question, what is my purpose on earth? And the reason they don't ask the question is because they don't think that the world has a purpose. You know, we can believe that the world has a purpose because for whatever it is, we cannot understand Hashem's mind, but Hashem had a reason for creating the world. I can't understand it, but no one can understand Hashem. But inasmuch as Hashem created the world, there was a reason that he did it. And in this created world, right, which has a purpose for its existence, right, Hashem gave us the Torah to tell us what our mission is in this world. Okay. You say that takes emunah? Granted. Right. But people who don't believe in creation, they don't believe in Hashem, they don't believe in God. How did the world come about? Well, what happened was then 14 billion years ago, or even more, there was a freak accident where energy condensed itself and formed into matter. It was a freak accident. It could have not happened. There was nothing that made it happen. It was just a freak accident. And then, once matter was created, it evolved over 14 or billion years or more into what we have now. You know, you might say that believing in God is not logical, right? Believing that the world developed into what it is now over 14 billion years without a designer is even more illogical. But according to people who don't say that Hashem created, that God created the world, then the world happened as an accident, then there's no purpose in the world's existence. It's only purposeful if it was created for a purpose. But if it happened as a freak accident, no purpose to it. And if the world as a whole does not have a purpose, how can any individual as an individual have a purpose in a purposeless universe? Well, you might say yes, but you know, we can have fine character traits, we can help each other and be kind to each other. That reminds me of the story of the two loafers, two vagrants, who were arrested for loitering. And they were brought before the judge. The judge turns to the first vagrant and he says, "Well, what were you doing when you were arrested?" The guy says, "Nothing." Turns to the second one and says, "And what were you doing when the officer arrested you?" He says, "I was helping him." How much can you be accomplishing if you are helping someone who's doing nothing? And if we have an entire population of the world who is not created for any purpose, right? So I don't see how anyone can have any ultimate purpose. And without any ultimate purpose, then it makes perfectly good sense to say, there is no purpose in life, there is no meaning in life. Have as much fun as you can, because the world is supposed to be a huge amusement park, a huge playground. When I grew up, it was not too easy to believe that. Because you see, in the 1930s, the world was not exactly a comfortable place to be. You know, in the United States at that time, the average life expectancy was before less than 50. And there was many diseases which people died of because there were no antibiotics. And young people, I remember young people dying of pneumonia. Every major city in the United States had a tuberculosis sanitarium which killed many people. Our house that I lived in was quarantined many times because of childhood diseases. And I had them all. Measles, chickenpox, whooping cough, mumps. I had them all. There was no immunization. Travel was difficult. You know, at that time, to get from America to what was at that time Palestine took 6 weeks. We do it now in 10 hours. And at the end of 6 hours, we're jumping at the bits, we're impatient. I traveled from Milwaukee to California by train, 60 hours, 2 days and 3 nights. There was no ways of communication. There certainly were no cell phones. There were certainly no smartphones. And there was no emails. And there were no fax machines. And you know, when the weather got real hot and it was 98 degrees outside, you sweat bullets. There was no air conditioning. The workplace was a workplace. There were no electronics. And much work was physical. The kitchen was a workplace. Okay? There were no dishwashers, no frozen foods, no takeouts, right? No microwaves. Right? You know something I sometimes fantasize? If in the 1930s somebody would have been told what life is going to be like in 2016. All the ease of transportation, the infectious diseases have been overcome, progress being made even toward cancer, powerful medications available that save lives, a home that is full of electronic conditions, and you can see anything that you wanted from any part of the world within seconds. They would say, you know, if you had told somebody in 1930 that this would happen, they would say, can't be, that's impossible. But if that does happen, that will have been an achievement of Gan Eden, of paradise in this world. You know, I believe that the people in 1930 were fortunate to be able to think that human beings could create a paradise. But here we are in 2016, and we are living in the paradise that man has created. And if this is paradise, you know, I sure wonder what Gehenna is like. There's still so much suffering, and so much brutality, and so much selfishness. Right. And I had the opportunity of watching how some people have been able to change their lives. Because you see, what is an addict? There are many definitions, but whether one is addicted to alcohol or to cocaine or to heroin or to gambling or addicted to sex, all of the kind of things are a person losing control over one's animalistic desires. You know, we come into the world as animals. And the knee of it spells it out even better. You come into the world as a wild mule. And from this wild mule, Hashem wants us to make something that is close to angels. No, we're not supposed to become angels. We're supposed to be human beings. Right? But we're supposed to be something more than intellectual animals. But here we have an entire culture which is highly educated and refers to human being as a... Here we have an entire culture which is highly educated and refers to human being as a Homo sapiens. What does that mean? If you translate it from the Latin into English, it means a gorilla with intelligence. Well, to me that's an insult. I don't want to be considered an intelligent gorilla. Right? And if life has no ultimate purpose, then I think that the people who say it's a playground, it's an amusement park, get all the fun you can as long as you can. And if it feels good, do it. Now you would think that the Torah world, which has such wonderful principles, is not affected by that. But we see that the Rambam tells us otherwise. The Rambam says we are influenced by our environment. So the secular world has said, if it feels good, do it. And so much of the Torah world has said, if it feels good and it's kosher, do it. And the Ramban in Vayikra chapter 19 comes along and says, no, that's not so. You can be a naval b'rshus HaTorah. You can be a vulgar person and be in total compliance with everything in the Torah. And that's why Rav Chaim Vital says that primary in Torah, even more important than the mitzvahs, that's a bold statement to make, even more important than mitzvahs is the character traits that Torah requires. And he says, look, we say tzedakah is a great mitzvah. Right? Gemilas chesed is a great mitzvah. Right? Overcoming our anger, our resentment is a great mitzvah. All of these wonderful character traits. Why doesn't the Torah tell them specifically? That it's a mitzvah to do chesed. We know how it's a mitzvah to do chesed because Avraham Avinu did chesed. The biblical characters are our teachers. And so the Chaim Vital asked a very good question. Why doesn't the Torah make a direct, explicit teaching about character traits as being mitzvahs? He says, because you cannot give mitzvahs to a human being who doesn't have character traits. Okay? If he doesn't have proper midot, right, then he cannot be accepting of Torah. And this is what the Ramban said. You can be observance of kosher to the greatest degree. And that doesn't stop you from being a naval, from being a crude, vulgar person. So what should we have accomplished in this past month? Right? We should have tried to change ourselves into being something more than a naval b'shus HaTorah. Something more than looking for more and more ways to enjoy. I'm not a killjoy. Right? It's wonderful to have enjoyment. In fact, when in the springtime, we make a bracha when the fruit trees begin to blossom, and in the bracha we say that we thank Hashem for creating a world to give Hanoah to His creatures. Hashem wants us to enjoy the world, but He wants us to enjoy the world as mentioned, not as animals. And that's where the importance of character traits come in. But you can only do that because that calls for sacrifice. To be rid of selfishness causes giving up of oneself. And this is where I learned so much from seeing people who were addicted to dangerous practices, whether it was alcohol or drugs or sexual promiscuity or pornography or compulsive gambling, and they were driven to it and they couldn't resist it. And they went on with it for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, spending a life in it with, motivated by, if it feels good, do it. And don't think about the consequences. And so Hashem put me in a place where I was exposed to people who had lived destructive lives of self-gratification, destructive lives of simply following their animalistic desires and having nothing else in life other than pleasure. And this was so that they brought ruination to themselves and to their families. And then something happened and they changed. The Rabbi Wolfenfuhr referred to the change as being a spiritual awakening. What is a spiritual awakening? A spiritual awakening is simply realizing I was not created to be an intelligent animal. I was created to serve Hashem. And I've seen some people think, oh, Avraham Avinu, his outstanding achievement was to teach people that there is one God. Because at that time the world was flooded with idolatry. And they worshipped everything that they came into sight with. And this one sefer says, no, that was not his main achievement. Because a person expects that God is there to serve him and to give satisfy his wishes. He says, that's also idolatry. When Avraham Avinu was said, you were created to serve Hashem, not that Hashem is here to serve you. And the service of Hashem and doing what Hashem wants and setting ourselves aside, that is what has enabled us to have the kind of mesilas nefesh, the kind of self-sacrifice as individuals and as a nation that has brought us to this day. And I've seen some people do that. But why did they do it? What stops an alcoholic after 30 years of drinking to give up? You say, yes, maybe he has liver disease, maybe he was arrested for drunk driving. I've seen cases where that was not so. I've seen cases where the only thing that happened was that the person came to a realization, I am too good to let this happen to me. There's a beautiful young man in Pittsburgh. He's not young anymore. He was young when I took him out of jail in 1972. Then he was a young man. Now he is 44 years free of drugs. Right? And he's become a real mensch. Right? Sensitive, ready to help everyone. Right? And some people have, through the phenomenon of addiction, they've learned some important lessons of life. There was one businessman was an alcoholic, and he became sober. And several years after he became sober, some people had a conspiracy to do him in, and they ruined him, and they made him bankrupt. And I met him one day, and he said to me, you know, I'm full of anger and full of bitterness about what they did to me. But I will go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight and I'll try to drop off my anger and resentment. Because you see, doctor, if I hang on to my anger and resentment, I will drink again. Right? This man realized a spiritual principle. That hanging on a grudge to someone else is absolutely foolishness. It's like holding a grudge against someone. One alcoholic said, that's like swallowing poison and thinking it's going to kill the other guy. Right? And realizing these are destructive feelings. hanging on to anger instead of getting rid of it, right, is a self-destructive thing. And we should realize ourselves that we are too good a people to let this happen to us. And so, you know, I've written books about self-esteem. How can a person possibly help self-esteem if he doesn't think his life is worth anything? Someone has said it so clearly. If there's nothing worth dying for, then there's nothing worth living for. Self-esteem is because I believe I have a function. And what is my function? Well, going through the myriad kind of activities of very life is a transient function. But it's not an ultimate purpose. There has to be some ultimate purpose that should give our lives value. What is self-esteem? What does it mean to give anything esteem? The word esteem comes from estimate. Right? How do you esteem something? Look around this house, look around your house, and see what value do you give to objects in the house? Well, some are very useful. They have a function. Some don't have any function, but they're very decorative. They're aesthetic. Right? So, suppose that you have a beautiful piece of furniture, it's a grandfather clock, but the mechanism stops working and it cannot be repaired. Well, it's a beautiful piece of furniture, so you keep it. But what happens if your can opener goes gullible? Right? And can't open cans anymore? It doesn't have any aesthetic value. It's not decorative, you're not going to hang it up. Right? So what do you do with a can opener that can't work anymore? You get rid of it because it has no value. I think those are the only values that we have. Either something is functional or something is decorative. Okay. Now let's look at ourselves. Are we decorative? Well, some people are fortunate that they're so beautiful, so handsome, that they may consider themselves as decorative, but even that eventually is going to fade in old age. Right? So, decorative is not the value of a human being. So what is the value of a human being? Right? Sitting in front of a TV with a six-pack watching a football game? I mean, that's not a terrible thing to do if you're not addicted. But it certainly is not the pride and the dignity of being a human being that one can find ways to satisfy one's desires. So the sefer that I have on my desk that I never let leave is Mesilas Yesharim, because it starts off with Chovas Ha'odam Ba'olamoy. And you know something? Ramchal has his own idea of what that purpose is, and you don't necessarily have to agree with him. Right? But what you do have to think about is, what is my purpose? Whether I agree with him, Ramchal, what is my purpose? Being an animal is not a dignified purpose for a being. And so a spiritual awakening is discovering that we're too good to be this. Now, I've made a little bit of a revolution in the 12-step program, because when people go to 12-step meetings, as for example Alcoholics Anonymous, they identify themselves only by first name, because we're anonymous. Right? And the person will get up and say, my name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic. Right? And I tell Frank, you know, you have to remember that you're an alcoholic, because if you forget it, you're going to drink again. But that is not all that you are. You are a beautiful person created by God. So what I want you to get up next time to do next time when you're called on, is get up and say, my name is Frank, I am a beautiful person who's an alcoholic. You have to remember both things. If you're going to forget that you're an alcoholic, you're going to drink again. Right? And if you forget that you're a beautiful person, you won't have any reason why not to drink again. And that's the beauty of Yiddishkeit and the beauty of Torah. And how important it is because before Hashem gave us the Torah, take a look, open the Yisrael, Parsha Yisrael. Hashem says, look, you have seen what I have done for you. I have delivered you from the slavery of Mitzrayim, and I've brought you on wings of eagles to me. And now you will listen to my teachings, right, and you will become a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And that's Chayvus Odom Bo'elalai. That's what we are to do. Right? And we are to be proud of being chosen by Hashem to fulfill His teachings and to make ourselves into the person that we are supposed to be. My first book, one of my first books was called Let Us Make Man. And it goes back to the pasuk in the title where on the sixth day of creation, after God had created the whole universe, millions of galaxies, came to the creation of man, Hashem said, Na'aseh Adam, let us make man. Who? Whose participation was Hashem asking for? And the Baal Shem says, it's very obvious. He says, everything else that Hashem created was created in a state of final perfection. An alligator doesn't have to become anything other than an alligator. It was born an animal, it remains an animal, and it follows all of its animalistic traits. The human being is supposed to be different. Hashem said, you know, I could make you into a beautiful, perfect spiritual creature, but then you would be an angel. You'd be a malach, totally spiritual. But I have enough of malachim already. I don't want another malach. I want the creature who is going to make himself spiritual. I'll give you the tools, but you've got to do the job. Okay. And that's why Hashem said, Na'aseh Adam, I will give you the tools, I will give you potential, and you make yourself into an Adam. That's the secret of Yiddishkeit. And in very simple terms, that's the secret of a happy family life. Do you know, if you keep your ears open by a chuppah, there's seven brachas that are recited. Two of them end up, Baruch Ato Hashem, Yoytze HaOdom. Hashem created Odom, Hashem created man. Why are we mentioning that? Why are we saying it twice? Because this is what we're telling the young couple. You want a happy marriage life? Be a mansion, not an animal. If you're going to be searching for your own gratification, and you'll be selfish and ignorant and inattentive to other person's needs, then you're not an Adam, you're still an animal. It's the beautiful traits that we have learned through Torah and Midos, that if we adopt them, we become real mention. I repeat this because it was very important to me and I want to share it with you. At age 73, my father developed cancer of the pancreas. He was very well versed in medicine, because for years he'd been visiting patients in the hospital and discussing their conditions with their doctors. And so he knew a great deal about medicine. And so he called me in and he said, for cancer of the pancreas, there's no treatment. I said, sometimes surgery, but without surgery, there's no treatment. And chemotherapy doesn't do anything for cancer of the pancreas. I said, no, it doesn't. But chemotherapy has a lot of painful side effects. Yes. Now, if taking chemotherapy would extend my life, then I think I'd be obligated to do it and accept the discomfort. But if it's not going to extend my life, and all it's going to do is give me the distressing side effects, it doesn't make any sense to do it. I said, you're right. All right, so we've come to a conclusion, right? We're not going to do chemotherapy. Yes, you're right. Then my mother talks to the doctor. And the doctor says to her, Mrs. Forsky, there is not much we can do for the rabbi. We could try chemotherapy. Maybe we could get an additional 3 months. And my mother said, 3 months? Well, you have to do chemotherapy for 3 days. And so she came into my father's room and she said, no, you're going to take chemotherapy. No ands, it's a buts. After she left the room, my father said to me, you know, it's unfortunately that mother was given misinformation. She thinks that chemotherapy is going to extend my life. But you know, if I refuse the chemotherapy, you know what her reaction is going to be when I die? Why did I not insist on it? If I had insisted on it, he could still be alive. And then she'll feel guilty for not having insisted on it. I don't want to leave the world with mom feeling guilty about it. So I'll take the chemotherapy. I know it's not going to accomplish anything for me, other than it'll prevent mother from having to feel guilty. That's what the event Yoytzer Ha'odom. That is what is being a mensch. Setting aside one's own comfort in order to prevent someone else from feeling bad. And that's Chayvus Odom El-Oilamai. No alligator can do that, no bear can do it, no lizard can do it, no eagle can do it. This is something unique for a human being. And this is what it takes us to be mentioned rather than intellectual animals. And so I've spent so many years talking about addiction. And maybe a little bit of a chutzpah that I find a little bit of identity with the great Yirmiyahu Hanavi, who told Hashem, why are you sending me to tell people things they don't want to hear? Right? And I started off in the 40 years ago, telling people, this idea that sugar is a goy is not true. Alcoholism is prevalent among Jews. Right? They wouldn't listen. Drug addiction is prevalent among the Jews. They wouldn't listen. There is no immunity. A person can be a scholar, and can be a Talmud Chacham and be subject to some of these addictions. They didn't want to listen. Compulsive gambling is an addiction. We're not immune to it. And then in the last 2 decades, the Sultan had a major victory by infiltrating our lives with immorality, right? Bringing the indecency and the obscenity and the filth of pornography into our homes. And many years ago, I think it was probably 12 years ago, where I received a letter from a young man who was a good yeshiva student, and he said, I'm caught in this trap of pornography. I've tried every way to get out of it, including psychotherapy, and I'm trapped. And he ends his letter by saying, you're hearing the last gasp of a dying soul. And 12 years ago, I had nothing to offer him. But then a few years later, something came upon the Jewish scene which has not been adequately appreciated. And that is a group of young people have gotten together and have said, use the fight fire with fire. Fight the evil of the internet with a positive teaching of the internet. Teach people how to guard their eyes, how to guard their souls, how to guard their bodies, how to avoid abusing the body that Hashem gave them. And so we now have a wonderful program called Guard Your Eyes. Right? And I am personally aware of hundreds of people, young men and young women, and older men and older women who have been saved by guard your eyes. And again, there is no immunity. I wish we could say that if a person puts on tefillin every day and keeps Shabbat, that that is the solution. I wish that were true. Unfortunately, people who have been observant in every other way have fallen into the trap of addiction, to sexual addiction, to pornography. And I found that the 12-step program has worked where nothing else has worked. And so I wrote the book, Teshuvah Through Recovery. That recovery will tell us what Teshuvah is really about. Rambam says that Teshuvah means becoming a different person. Eineni oto ha'ish. I'm not the same person who behaved the way I did. I no longer do that. And that has been the greatness of the 12-step program. And it's true, it was designed by Bill Wilson, who's not Jewish. But he didn't design it. He just stole it from the Sefer Musa. Yeah. In fact, if Bill Wilson would be alive today, I would have him sued for plagiarism. Because if you go through the 12 steps one by one, and I've written a book about that, right? If you go through the steps one by one, and it's in this book also, you will see how these are the principles of Musa, of making yourself into a different person, and not deceiving yourself. There's one alcoholic who said to me, "You know, doctor, in all my years of drinking, I never once took a drink unless I decided it was the right and proper thing to do at the time." That's how you can deceive yourself. Right? But it's a destructive self-deception. And as I said, all forms of addiction, including smoking. And I'll never forget to forget mentioning smoking. Smoking is a terrible addiction. And in fact, many of the poskim have said that it's absolute forbidden. It's forbidden to smoke cigarettes according to halacha. And I must tell you that when I see sometimes going to a yeshiva and I see young people smoking, I say, hey, they're missing the boat. They're missing the boat. I have a book called From Bondage to Liberty, which is a Perush of Haggadah of Pesach. One addict who had recovered from years of drug abuse was at his father's Seder, and his father started reading the Haggadah, Avadim Hayinu. And this young man said to his father, Abba, can you truthfully say about yourself, Avadim Hayinu, that you personally were an avid? You say, Avadim Hayinu, our ancestors thousands of years ago. You don't know what it means to be an avid. I can tell you what it means to be an avid. Because all those years that I was addicted to drugs, I was an avid. I was not free. I could not live the way I wanted to. My taskmaster was drugs. I did things in my life that I never thought I was capable of doing. But the drugs made me do it. And any time we give up our freedom, whether we become addicted to pornography, or addicted to alcohol, or to drugs, or to gambling, or to food, or to smoking, or to whatever, if we lose our liberty, we're back in Mitzrayim, having created our own power. And that's something that we should be careful of. So I wanted to share these ideas with you tonight, because we just finished this wonderful new season. Beginning of a new year that is, with Ezra Hashem, going to be a Shana Tova Metuka, a sweet year for all of us. But to realize we have to come away from the Tishrei season with a realization of something that we have achieved. And not to believe that just we did it all on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and the 10 days of Tshuva that the work is done. It has to be done afresh and anew every day. And in Yirtzeh Hashem, if we will do that and work on our spirituality and our midot, every day and becoming what Hashem wanted us to be, a true Adam, rather than a Homo sapien intellectual gorilla, right? We will merit the blessings of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Bracha, Hatzlacha, Lechus Yamin, Begashmi, Sebrochnias. As the rabbi mentioned in his introduction, we're going to have some information about Gardner Eyes. Gardner Eyes, as far as I'm concerned, is the only effective method that we've had for stopping people from being slaves to an addiction which is breaking their lives, ruining families, and ruining children. So I'm going to turn it over now to the Guard Your Eyes staff.
Guard Your Eyes. I'm known by my username, Hopeful.